Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Hey, March is Problem Gambling Awareness Month, so with Connecticut recently opening up many new ways to lay down and lose or win a bet, For the People is turning to a top resource at Wheeler Health for some straight talk on how to respond if you or someone you know, even a teen or young adult in your world, is experiencing unhealthy gambling habits. Then we're flipping to an important environmental concern, how Connecticut and our nation is losing a serious amount of its bird population, and how that trend is creating an ecological domino effect that has the potential to impact everyone across the state. And have you heard that Governor Lamont is looking for $70 million in this year's state budget to step up a program to remediate lead in Connecticut households? Well, For the People is all over it with our connection at the US EPA, which is launching a series of listening sessions this coming week so folks can call in and discuss their risks and challenges to eliminating lead exposure in their own community. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. You can join BH Care on June 4th for their annual A Chance to Shine celebration and benefit at Quarry Walk in Oxford. At 10 a.m., walk in honor of victims of domestic violence. Then the Community Fun Day continues with food trucks, live music, a Touch a Truck event, and more. You can support the BH Care family of programs, including BH Care's Valley and Shoreline Clinics, the Umbrella Center for Domestic Violence Services, the Parent-Child Resource Center, the Hope Family Justice Center, and the Alliance for Prevention and Wellness. All proceeds benefit these critical and life-saving services that BH Care provides to Connecticut adults and children. Want to know more? Go to achancetoshinect.org. Well, here we are, the first program of March, and a lot of things are happening here in March, but regular listeners to the program, especially longtime listeners, know that for well over 20 years, we've been talking about resources for individuals who get stuck in the cycle of problem gambling. And March is Problem Gambling Awareness Month, which underscores the challenges of problem gambling and available resources through programs like the one we're going to talk about today at Wheeler's Better Choice Gambling Treatment Program. That's BETTOR. I just got that when I opened up the document here. All along, I was thinking it's a better choice, but it's a better choice, a gambling treatment program. And the person that we're talking to is a gambling problem gambling support specialist, Katie Kirsch. She's clinical supervisor for the Better Choice program. Katie, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
From your program to our program, as we said, we really started talking about resources for problem gambling here in Connecticut way back when the casinos first opened up a little over 20 years ago. And we've been talking about it ever since. But man, has it been an 18 months to beat the band in terms of opening up other options for people to kind of, think they're having fun at first and maybe winning a few bucks. But I have to imagine Wheeler's phones at the Better Choice program are now ringing off the hook. Tell us a little bit about the program and how it came to be.
So the Better Choice program, so Wheeler is actually one of five gambling treatment programs in the state of Connecticut. So we service folks from about the Hartford area all the way up to the Mass border. So we service North Central Connecticut. We have treatment locations in Hartford, Bristol, and New Britain. And our team of clinicians are, we are licensed professionals, so we hold the same licenses that you'll find if you're seeking, therapy through a private practice or anywhere else. But we have additional training in the field of problem gambling. So It's sort of unlike the treatment that you'll find elsewhere if gambling is an issue for you. So we are an outpatient level of care, so we do primarily individual therapy. We do have group treatment as an option for those who are interested. We do medication management. You know, we treat co-occurring disorders. You know, it's not just gambling. So people often come in with other things going on, whether there's anxiety or depression, often related to the gambling. We see high rates of co-occurring issues, some substance use. So we can sort of treat the whole person.
It's interesting that you say that, because I remember learning for the first time years ago that individuals who may have had a substance addiction, who have feel that they've beat it, and are clean and sober, sometimes for years, if not decades, those are people that may be at least proportionally higher risk to become addicted to problem gambling, because I guess the incredible brain and the chemicals in it sort of function the same way with the juice you get out of gambling as sometimes you did from things like nicotine, cigarettes, even opioids.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, this behavior does not come without risks, and people who are in recovery from other substances are definitely a high risk population. So it's something to just keep in mind that this is not a risk free activity. Most people gamble, and most people don't have a problem with it, but there are there's a group of people that will struggle with problems, and being in recovery from other things is definitely a risk factor. So something to just keep in mind.
Yeah, I guess a good way to think of it is that, you take a room full of 25 people and 22 of them can, have a glass of wine with dinner and head home a couple of hours later and everything's fine. And then you have the other few people that are having wine before dinner, for dinner, after dinner, and when they get home from dinner. And these are the people similar to those who may start out, just maybe hearing a commercial and going to, one of these new online betting sites or online gambling and entertainment programs. And then, a week later, a month later, a couple months later, they're having a hard time paying the mortgage because all the money has been sucked into the handheld.
Right. That's right. And, when I'm talking to clients, I'm often explaining this disorder very similarly to alcohol. I'll say, gambling's legal. Alcohol's legal. Most people can drink. Most people don't have a problem with it. Most people can gamble. Most people don't have a problem with it, but that doesn't mean that it's something that doesn't have risks attached to it. And we have to be aware of that. We have to know our own limits. We have to know what we can and can't afford to lose. And we have to just sort of stay on top of ourselves and, make decisions that work best for us.
So you guys have provided a really interesting statistic as a talking point today, Katie, and that is that rates of problem gambling double when people are within a certain proximity of a gambling establishment. Now, that certainly may have been an issue with off-track betting and Keno and the casinos, but now, it's also almost become cliche, but you literally, if you have a smartphone, you're holding a casino in your hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is an old statistic because, in the past, and talking to some of my older clients, it used to be that they would have to drive to Atlantic City to gamble, or they would fly out to Vegas to gamble. Then we got our casinos in Connecticut, and then it was just a 40-minute drive or a 20-minute drive for folks. Mm-hmm. So the risk, became greater and greater, and more people became vulnerable to this addiction. But exactly now, everyone's got access to it right in their hands, right in their own homes. And so, unfortunately, it will create more problems down the road. We're already seeing an increase in calls compared to the numbers last year. We've about doubled, callers to our helpline. Mm. So there's definitely already an increase, and it's happening much quicker. You know, when MGM was built in Massachusetts, we thought, okay, let's get ready because we're going to start seeing a lot more problems in the northern Connecticut area for people reaching out for help. And they did, but it took a little bit of time. It took more like 6 months to a year for us to start getting callers that said, okay, well, I used to go to Mohegan Sun, but now I go to MGM. But with this online, it's just happening so much quicker. So from October to now, we've definitely seen a large increase in calls.
The other thing I think it's really important to talk about is how much more prevalent, due to the mobile device use, that problem gambling is infiltrating a younger and younger demographic. I mean, when I was in high school, back in the mid and early 70s, you know, we had a football card and we could check off our boxes and maybe win a couple of bucks. And, you know, that was a fad for a while. And then when the casinos opened, maybe, you know, go up there and pull a few slots or whatever. But now with the availability of gambling on mobile devices, you got to be really worried about kids, even maybe as young as middle school age, right?
Yeah, you know, we do a lot of prevention work in Connecticut, which is really fantastic to get the messaging out and to spread awareness to youth that again, they are a vulnerable population. And, you know, there are some good things in place in terms of online gambling where the legal age is 21. You do have to enter, you know, social security numbers and valid credit card information and things like that. So there are some, you know, ways to protect our youth, but they do need to know that they are certainly at risk, especially if they're highly involved in video gaming or play a lot of those games where there can sort of be a little bit of gambling elements kind of in those games. Could potentially put kids at risk for future problems down the road.
A gambling training program, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's switch gears and let people know all the wonderful and effective resources that you can help provide them through Wheeler. And I'm not just talking about individuals who may recognize in themselves or by looking at the bottom line in their bank account that they better get some support, but you're also there for the loved ones and family members who are along for the ride, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, we highly, highly encourage family members to get involved in treatment. You know, a lot of times people think, well, you know, it's my spouse or my child that has the gambling problem. They're the ones that need help. And we get a lot of calls from family members just wanting more information about our program. And, you know, I'll often say to them, you know, if your loved one isn't willing to come into treatment now, are you willing to come in? And, you know, I sort of catch them off guard because they think, well, I'm not the one with the problem. But we know that one gambler impacts up to 20 people around them, and that's family members, people in the community, their friends. This addiction does impact a lot of people. So we talk to them about how we can help them work through some of the emotions that they're feeling. They're probably feeling angry right now. They're probably feeling lack of trust in the relationship. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to help. They don't know the do's and don'ts of this addiction. How do I really help them? What should I do? What shouldn't I do? We help them work on, you know, rebuilding marriages and rebuilding financial and emotional trust again in relationships. And how can we get you guys on the same page? So oftentimes when I approach it in that way, they'll say, okay, well, you know, I actually am feeling all of those things. I am feeling hurt. I am feeling angry. I don't trust them anymore. You know, what do I do? And I'll say, well, you know, this is exactly the thing we can help you with. So we try to do family sessions as often as we can. If family members aren't willing to come in, we'll talk to our clients and say, you know, can you bring your spouse in? Can you bring your sister in? She's a big support for you. Let's bring her in and do one family session and you know, just help the whole family unit, because this addiction doesn't just impact one person. It impacts the entire family dynamics.
Very good. WheelerHealth.org/betterchoice. That's BETTORCHOICE is the website to go if you'd like to learn more about this program. But Katie, in the last 30 seconds or so that we have for people who may have joined us late here in the first weekend of Problem Gambling Awareness Month, could you just remind folks down in Fairfield and New Haven County how they might be able to access similar resources?
Yeah, the best phone number to call in the state of Connecticut, if you're not sure if my program or another Better Choice program is in your area, you can call the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling's helpline at 1-888-789-7777. They're there 24/7. They have text and chat options, and they'll guide you to the program that is closest to you.
Wheeler's program is one of five gambling-specific treatment programs funded by the Connecticut Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. March is Problem Gambling Awareness Month. If you think you have an issue or someone you love does, please get in touch with the services that can give you the support and guidance that you need to wind your way out of it. Katie Kirsch is with is the clinical supervisor of the Better Choice program for Wheeler up in Central Connecticut. Katie, we thank you for your resource this morning. Well, as they say on the TV show, look up in the sky, it's a bird. That's right. And here we're here to talk about birds this morning. We're so pleased to welcome Tom Anderson onto the program and welcome back Connecticut Audubon. It's been years and years since we've had Connecticut Audubon on the program. And I hope, Tom, that this conversation is the beginning of some regular visits by you and other members of your organization. Connecticut Audubon's mission is to protect Connecticut's birds, other wildlife, and their habitats through conservation, education, and advocacy. And we're going to find out all kinds of awesome ways that you can learn more about birds, protecting and sustaining our populations, and the role those birds play in the greater kind of patchwork of our environment here in Connecticut, in the Northeast, and in our global community. Tom, appreciate you joining us this morning. So let's kick off the conversation talking about a really important report that came out a couple of months ago called The State of Birds. What does that report have to say about things happening right here in our neighborhoods in southern and central Connecticut?
We publish a report called Connecticut State of the Birds, where we pick a timely and we hope relevant theme and find authors who can write articles in it. It's essentially a magazine. It's magazine format. And this year, we looked at an issue that was raised about 2 years ago when a bunch of ornithologists published a report in the journal Science that documented that over the last 50 years, North America has lost almost 30% of its bird population, 3 billion fewer birds in North America now than there were in 1970. And we thought that what we wanted to do was get a couple of articles in the report that took a broad view and then sort of drill down to four or five or six specific birds that are either once were common or should be common in Connecticut and look at what's being done to try to bring those back. We titled the report, 3 billion birds are gone. How do we bring them back? And the two key articles were one by a fellow named Pete Mara, who, Pete was the director of the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center when that science report came out. He was one of the authors of that report in Science. And we got Pete to write an article titled The Uncertain Road to Recovering 3 Billion Birds. And what he did was he quickly reviewed he quickly reviewed the work they had done to come to the conclusion that we had lost 3 billion birds. But then he sort of threw down the gauntlet for doing better. He made the point that if we've lost 3 billion birds in 50 years, then our bird protection laws really aren't doing the job. The Endangered Species Act, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, they were good for their time, but they're not enough. And we need to do better, and we need to have broader coalitions. We need to focus on the species that are not quite endangered, but are sort of in danger of being endangered to make sure that they don't reach that threshold.
Yeah.
And then we asked Pete, by the way, I forget if I mentioned this, but Pete is grew up in Norwalk. He's a local guy. He's now at Georgetown University. And we have a great connection with him because he started his career at Connecticut Audubon.
Okay.
Now he happens to be one of the more prominent ornithologists in the country.
Yeah.
We also asked Dr. Brooke Bateman, who is the lead climate scientist for the National Audubon Society. And remember, Connecticut Audubon is independent. We work with National Audubon, but we're not part of them. And Brooke was important to us because she has co-authored a couple of studies that look at the effect on bird abundance of climate change, and also most recently what to do about it. That most recent report was called Natural Climate Solutions, and what Brooke and her team discovered, and which Brooke wrote about for State of the Birds, is that the United States can basically reach about 25% of its carbon reduction goals by strategic land preservation. And what they did was they mapped places that are important for carbon sequestration, as they call it, and places that are important for bird habitat. And the places that overlapped, they identified those as being the most important for preservation. And it turns out that in Connecticut, there are about 1.2 million acres that fit that description. And to us, it's a really important call to action to pick up the pace of land preservation in Connecticut, because it's good for birds and it's good for climate goals. And we're not sure that it's as much a part of the climate change conversation in Connecticut as it should be.
So just to try to frame this for folks that are listening, could you talk about one particular species that is approaching or possibly on the endangered list, or possibly even one that we may have already lost, and how that species plays an important, if not critical, role in the larger kind of, as I said, patchwork of our environment? Is there a bird that you're particularly concerned about, a species that you're concerned about that through either the decimation of their population or elimination of it is going to have a definitive impact on some element of our overall environmental health?
Well, I'll talk about a bird that we're very concerned about. And, it's a little bit hard to say how one species fits into the overall environmental health, particularly because we're not really talking about one species here. Mm-hmm. Pete Mara's lab identified 80 species that they consider to be urgent cases to help preserve.
Mm-hmm.
But the bird I'll talk about is a little shorebird called the semi-pollinated sandpiper. And anyone who goes to the beach in spring and late summer and fall will have seen it, even if they're not sure. They know it. It's a tiny little shorebird, a tiny little sandpiper, and it winters along the northeastern coast of South America, Venezuela, Suriname, and migrates through our area, including at our Milford Point Coastal Center, and stops on its way. It nests in the Arctic. It stops on its way north and south at our beaches and along Delaware Bay, on the Delaware River, to rest and to feed. And over the past 50 years or so, the population of semi-pollinated sandpipers has plunged by 80%. four out of every five semi-palmated sandpipers are gone. Mm. The fellow who wrote the article for us for State of the Birds is a guy named David Mizrahi, who is a PhD scientist for the New Jersey Audubon Society. And his work discovered that from like the mid-1990s to the mid-2000s, the number of horseshoe crabs on Delaware Bay, the horseshoe crab population was decimated by fishermen who take horseshoe crabs to use for bait in the eel fishery and the whelk fishery. And it's horseshoe crab eggs that are essential for semi-palmated sandpipers. Huh. And a professor named Jennifer Matei from Sacred Heart University in Fairfield has found the same thing in Connecticut, that the horseshoe crab population has plummeted. And the result is that there's not a dense enough concentration of horseshoe crab eggs for these birds to eat. And so it's interesting because it shows the connection between, an innocuous species like the horseshoe crab, which everybody knows, and a very common shorebird, the semi-palmated sandpiper, and how if you exploit one and the population goes down, you're affecting the other as well.
Very good. Hey, Tom, we're going to take a very brief break because this conversation is extremely good. And we want to come back. We're going to talk about what you're hearing out there in the woods. Maybe it's a red-shouldered hawk. We're going to take an opportunity to invite people to the 5th Annual Migration Madness Birdathon, as well as the upcoming remainder of your Young, Gifted, and Wild About Birds Zoom series. Stay with us, folks. We'll be back with Tom Anderson of Connecticut Audubon. And I will say, if you're interested in learning more about what this organization does, please visit them at ctaudubon.org. We'll be right back. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Our friends at Homes for the Brave is presenting For Veterans, By Veterans Comedy Night, and it's back and better than ever for its sixth consecutive year on Friday, April 8th. Vizzano's Four Seasons in Stratford will provide a fabulous dinner, and you'll get a shot at taking home door prizes, proceeds from a 50-50 raffle, and you'll bust out with a hilarious lineup of professional comics, all U.S. military veterans. Come out and check out Navy vet Scotty Lombardi and National Guard vet Quentin Davis, along with headliner and Navy vet Mitch Stinson. If you want to get tickets, get them now by visiting homesforthebrave.org/comedy. All right, we're back, and Tom Anderson's with us from CT Audubon, the start of a renewed relationship with this critically important organization and nonprofit here in Connecticut, ctaudubon.org. I just drove by the CT Audubon Center the other day when I was down tooling through Fairfield County, and we hope that folks will go and learn more about this organization and the important work they do, including some interesting activities that they have coming up. But before we do that, Tom, let's switch gears. We talked about the sandpipers, but now folks are not just going to be seeing, but they're going to be hearing some particular birds here in Connecticut. Tell me about the red-shouldered hawks.
Yeah, sure. Red-shouldered hawks, it's an amazing bird. It's one of a handful of hawks that are in Connecticut year-round, and it tends to be a bird of the woodlands, although I live in a wooded suburban area near the border of New York, and they're around here. But the thing is that in late February, they start to form pair bonds, so they're getting ready to nest, and the males start to establish territory, and you can hear them. They'll fly high above the trees, and sometimes right in the tree, through the branches, Cawing and screeching like crazy. I'm not going to attempt to imitate it, but years and years ago, when I first heard it, it was the first time I'd heard one, because they made something of a comeback. And I thought, that almost sounds like a gull. What kind of bird could that be? And when I finally identified it, it was a red-shouldered hawk. And as I said, that this sort of marks the beginning of the breeding season for them.
And quite a distinct sound. I mean, if people are out, you know, just walking in their suburban neighborhood or in a wooded park or out in one of the regional forests right around this time of the year, they may hear that screeching call repeating and repeating and repeating. So
they probably will. And it's once you hear it, it's unmistakable. You'll hear it. You'll hear it from February right through the spring, but then you'll remember it next February and hear it again. They always start right around the third week of February.
Awesome. Well, what you are helping us all learn today about birds, you can do for so many more people, and actually kind of bring them into the Audubon family to do good. And one of the ways you do that is with your annual Migration Madness Birdathon. The fifth annual Birdathon is coming up in May. What's that all about?
Yeah, so put this one on your calendar. It's middle of May, May 13, 14, and 15. We have a weekend of birding activities, the centerpiece of which is a birdathon. And a birdathon is essentially people sign up to spend the weekend or any part of the weekend looking for as many bird species in Connecticut as they can. And they submit it to us via the eBird app. And we have prizes for people who see the most species. We have prizes for kids. Because the best birders tend to dominate by seeing the most species, we have a different prize every year, which we give out based on a raffle. So if you enter and see a minimal number of birds, you're entered into the raffle to win this prize. Last year it was a bird carving by a fellow named Keith Mueller, who is actually an incredibly talented bird carver. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the prize will be this year, but it'll be something like it. But the idea is that the reason it's a fundraiser is because the people who participate go out and take pledges for how many birds they'll see. And when the event is over, we help them collect the pledges. They're all charitable donations. Mm. And we use all the money. It goes directly into our bird conservation fund. We use it specifically to help birds and bird habitats here in Connecticut.
Excellent. Well, we've got about 4 minutes left with you, Tom. So let's switch gears and invite people to do something that they don't even have to, get out of their pajamas for. Especially if they have a camera that just focuses on their face, or they have one of those memes that kind of gets put up on their Zoom screen. Young, Gifted, and Wild About Birds. This series has already begun, but there are three more really cool Zoom. Events coming up. Give us the quick rundown on those.
Sure. Young, Gifted, Wild About Birds is our attempt to present younger generation scientists and people doing interesting things in the bird world. We started it during the pandemic, frankly, because it was impossible for people to get to our centers. We weren't doing in-person programming. So we started this, and the three that are coming up, we have an artist named Jenny Kreuk, who people may know because her work has been on the cover of the New Yorker magazine. It's been in lots of other magazines. She is going to talk about how she has used painting and sketching birds to get to know her local birds. She lives in New York City, her local birds better, and how regular people can use sketching and painting to come to know the birds better. She'll give a presentation, and she'll actually paint a bird for us during the presentation. Cool. That one's scheduled for March 3rd, 7 in the evening, and you can get the details at ctaudubon.org. The next two are March 23rd and April 21st. We have a couple of young PhD scientists who have been studying grassland birds at Freshkills Park on Staten Island. Freshkills Park used to be Freshkills Landfill, the mm-hmm. largest landfill in the world.
Wow.
When it was closed, it was turned into a grassland park, and they've had incredible success with grasshopper sparrows, sedge wrens, savanna sparrows. They're going to talk about their work there and how it applies to grasslands in Connecticut. And the final one is the day before Earth Day. It'll be Thursday evening, April 21st. A PhD candidate named Murray Burgess is going to talk about her work studying barn swallows, which will just be returning to Connecticut during that week, and what she's discovered about how they react to light pollution and how it might be affecting their reproduction and their abundance. These things are inexpensive. You know, we charge just a nominal fee, so I can pay the speakers a small honorarium.
Yeah.
They've gotten a great result. You just need to go to our website and sign up.
Very good. So in the last minute or two that we have with you, Tom, just remind folks how they can either support or further engage with Connecticut Audubon, beginning with visiting in person your center down in Fairfield County.
We have 20 sanctuaries around the state and 7 centers. We have 2 in Fairfield. We have our Milford Point Coastal Center, which is one of the best birding spots in New England. We have a 800-acre grassland center in Pomfret. We have a 850-acre wooded sanctuary in Sherman called Deer Pond Farm. We have a new, smaller sanctuary in Old Lyme at our Roger Torrey Peterson Estuary Center. Visiting those places is the best way to start if you're unfamiliar with Connecticut Audubon. But also just go to our website and poke around. We've recently revised our sanctuary pages. We have information about all of the activities going on at our centers. And of course, look for the membership button and become a member. That's the best way. That's the sort of the introductory way to help Connecticut's birds by becoming a member of Connecticut Audubon.
Fantastic. Founded in 1898, the Connecticut Audubon Society envisions that their efforts will lead to a future where all can share and experience the joys of nature and understand the importance of environmental preservation. ctaudubon.org is their website to get you started. And Tom Anderson is their spokesperson from Connecticut Audubon, our guest this morning in this midpoint of the show. Tom, thank you so much for your time. And hopefully we'll see you out at one of the Connecticut Audubon centers or out in the woods listening for those hawks one of these days. Thanks for your time.
Yeah. You're welcome. Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, we're back and visiting again with our friends from EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, here in Connecticut, actually being served out of the Region 1 office in Boston. And so pleased to make the acquaintance of Christy Ray Simoneau, who is the chief of the Multimedia Assistance and Support Branch. But we are here today in part to talk about some really important business. Regular listeners know that forever on the award, on the award-winning For the People, we have been talking about lead. Lead exposure, mitigation, lead poisoning. We are living in an environment that is rich in older building stock, and that means likely that there is lead somewhere in or around any structure or facility that was built prior to the mid-1970s or thereabouts. And Christy, please do correct me on that if I'm wrong. So the bottom line is that I heard from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency a few weeks ago, and I'm excited to know they're hosting a series of public listening sessions on something called a draft strategy to reduce lead exposures and disparities in U.S. communities. It's happening across the country, but as we speak and as this program airs here on the first weekend of March, coming up on March 8th at 6 p.m. is the EPA Region 1's first New England-focused listening session, and we're going to tell you why it's important for you to be part of it if you have any interest in ensuring that your community, your neighborhood, or the building where you live or work is free of lead or that you are best protected from it. So, Christy, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much, John. We appreciate the invite today, and we're very grateful to have a platform with you and your listeners that are already so knowledgeable about lead. So it's fantastic.
Yeah. So before we get into that, let's hear a little bit about yourself and the work that you do there at the EPA, because lead is far from the only thing on your radar. I understand from chatting a few minutes before we turned on the microphone that you really engage with not just individuals throughout New England on public health, but you're also engaged in kind of like economic development and business relations. And you not only work and advise and help and support folks in New England, but you work with a network of other similar professionals across the country to make sure that EPA Region 1 office is right on the cutting edge and able to bring the latest, best information to your constituents. So tell us a little bit more about what you do out of the Boston office.
Oh, absolutely. You know, John, you already said it very well, but EPA has a fantastic mission. It's our job and privilege to protect public health and the environment, the air, the water, the land. And in Region 1, we serve the six New England states, including Connecticut, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Vermont, and Maine, and 10 federally recognized tribal nations. And for me, I've worked at EPA for about 24 years, and my team works with state and local partners to design training and tools and whatever kind of compliance assistance we can to help businesses and other regulated entities comply with the environmental regulations. And I'm very grateful to have a job where I can say I'm here to help and really mean it.
So you're in an excellent position and a fantastic resource due to the length of your tenure with the EPA. I'm most interested in hearing, as the agency transferred from mostly paper to almost no online or computing-based resources to, you know, relatively paperless compared to virtual resources, access, and things in regards to compliance. Where would you say that your office stands right now in terms of really being able to provide, easy virtual ways for businesses and others in our communities here in Connecticut to engage with the EPA on either information gathering, resources, or conforming and compliance?
You know, it's a great question, and I think the global pandemic has required all of us to think very creatively and innovatively about how can we use the internet and whatever platforms we can to safely reach people. And on the assistance side, what I can say is we've leaned a lot towards web-based trainings for actually a long time now, recognizing that not everybody has the resources to drive or take time off to do in-person trainings. And so we've migrated more towards electronic email notifications, posting stuff on the web, and being able to provide on-demand kind of video-based content. Hmm. So people can really access it at their convenience. So they're not tied to when a particular event is.
Oh, so if, as people are paring down either voluntarily or by virtue of the fact that they can't find workers and they're pressed into doing a lot more work with a lot fewer people, and I guess in a lot of cases with smaller businesses, maybe even the bosses putting on the boots and jumping in the pickup and going out and doing a lot of this work themselves, you're providing an easy and convenient way for them to be able to actually put in a full work day and then, maybe go home, have dinner, and have a cup of tea and sit in front of the computer and get something done that they might otherwise would have had to take an entire day or two off to be able to go and travel and do it in person.
Well, that's definitely the goal. And for example, one of the things that we worked on in Connecticut were some online and evening trainings where we were really reaching out to contractors and renovators, painters who really needed to know, how do you get certified to renovate right and reduce dust to make sure any jobs are safe? And we had really good response kind of holding that web-based training in the evening after work hours based on a lot of input. And we're in the process of captioning that training so it can be accessed on demand. So we're trying to find innovations like that whenever we can.
So in terms of, the environmental, the elements in the environment that have a potential to do harm, does your office provide resources and training and certification and compliance for the kind of workforce that you just described, these contractors and renovators, on things including lead, or is your real focus mostly on lead related issues?
That's a great question. So my office and my team works on more issues than just lead. But, related to lead, Region 1 oversees several different federal regulations that are addressing lead in housing and school, drinking water, the air, the soil, all the areas that you know from experience where lead can be. And working with state partners like the Connecticut Department of Public Health, and even local government officials like code enforcement officers to make sure people and businesses are following the rules and doing their work the right way to keep families and children safe. We also give grant funding to support lead programs and support projects, conducting inspections to make sure everybody's following the rules and we can respond to any tips and complaints from the public. In addition to some of the trainings that we talked about, like how to renovate right, safely dispose of any construction materials, mm-hmm. and really spread the word to parents, families, daycare centers, schools, really reach the places where kids live, learn, and play, and help them understand how to stay safe from lead.
Great. Well, a great way to transition to the subject at hand as well. The draft strategy to reduce lead exposures and disparities, I imagine, is either completed or in its final stages. And coming up, beginning on March 8th, are these listening sessions that invite folks from Connecticut to get involved. Did I guess right? Is the draft essentially completed or near complete, and the public input will help you actually put the fine points on it?
Oh, absolutely. It is draft for a reason, because we really, really do want everyone's voice to be heard as we're figuring out how to keep tackling this complex problem. Would it help if I covered a few pieces in the strategy just at a high level?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. Well, honestly, I could talk a long time about it, but let me talk about a few of the key kind of new approaches. This strategy is really emphasizing EPA to work locally to figure out how we can address lead contamination for communities that have the greatest remaining problems and promote environmental justice. That means looking at data and information that's available to find where lead exposure and blood lead levels are known or we suspect them to be a problem, figuring out which pathways and sources, lead can be a lot of different places in the environment, and then figure out how we use best practices to focus and make a difference in those areas. And that local work will be coupled with the second prong, which is working nationally. And that's really trying to strengthen public health protections, making sure that our standards, our guidance are protective, developing new tools and outreach to make sure, especially that we are reducing exposure and in particular, soliciting stakeholder input like these listening sessions to help inform how we create and make our decisions on how we're going to focus our resources. And the last piece I'll touch on briefly is just a new commitment to work together across all of EPA. We have lots of different programs, like we talked about earlier, drinking water, toxics, air, land, children's health. And this strategy really asks EPA to take more of a holistic view, a whole of government view, a whole of EPA approach, both inside the agency and outside, including our partners, because, John, we can't do this alone. EPA has one part, but we need other federal partners. We need our states, our tribes, cities, local government, nonprofit, the industry, parents, everybody working together, getting the right information to people at the right time so they can help prevent exposure. And as EPA, we can use our full range of resources in the areas that need it the most. And we really hope that this new plan will take our lead work and our public health work to the next level and help us focus all that we can do with our partners to make a difference.
So I imagine that there are, moms and dads or families getting ready to go out on a Sunday morning, or folks that saw this previewed on our social network and they clicked in to listen to the podcast because they have an interest in it. Maybe construction workers, folks working in a deli or in a convenience store or something like that. Speak right to the audience that are listening to this program or podcast and explain who you want to call in and participate in these listening sessions.
You know, John, we want to hear from every part of Connecticut, New England. We want to hear from parents, from families, from community and neighborhood groups, daycare centers and child care providers. If you're working at a school, if you're a contractor or a painter that works on repairs and renovation, or a landlord, if you work in a building association, a doctor, a nurse, really anyone interested in sharing ideas is welcome. And, you know, EPA is ready to provide translation services too. So if you have a colleague or friend or family member that would really like to participate but isn't comfortable speaking in English, just please tell us what is needed when you register and we'll do the rest. I think we have many different languages listed there, but there's also a place to list more or any that we may have missed.
Great. So the first listening session is March 8th from 6 to 9 p.m. here in the Connecticut area, and registration is required to attend the event. Now, I would say, the URL is a little unwieldy, epa.gov/lead/draft-strategy-reduce-lead-exposures. If folks just go to epa.gov/lead, will they be able to access or route their way to applying to be part of the listening session?
Absolutely. And, you know, the other way, because it is a mouthful, mm-hmm. These URLs, right. Oftentimes if you can get on the internet and use your favorite search engine and just type in EPA lead strategy March 8th, you'll find news and links to register. And with just a few clicks, you should be able to be set. And I will add too that if you happen to be busy on March 8th and already have plans, you can participate at any of the other lead sessions that are being held. That website, www.epa.gov/lead, has the whole schedule. And folks can also follow a process to submit comments directly to a different website if you don't feel comfortable speaking or don't have time to be in a listening session. Excellent. So really, that website will work for when at whatever time works for you.
Fantastic. Christy Ray Simono is with the EPA Region 1 office serving Connecticut out of Boston. And once again, the agency, the EPA, is hosting this series of public listening sessions on the draft strategy to reduce lead exposures and disparities in U.S. communities. They want to hear your voice, starting with the listening session coming up at 6 p.m. on March 8th. EPA.gov/lead is where to get started. And if you can't participate on March 8th and can participate in one of the other listening sessions, or just file your ideas online. That's your source. Christy, great to talk to you, and thank you so much for all this great information and reminders about all the different ways that the EPA Region 1 office in Boston is helping us here have a healthier and better Connecticut. We appreciate your time this morning. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.